You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Mike Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm, KCRW's literary show. Today, we're going to be talking about a new anthology of poems called Under 35, The New Generation of American Poets. The anthology was published by Doubleday under their Anchor Book imprint. It's available in paperback, and it was edited by Nicholas Christopher. With me in the studio are two L.A. poets who appear in that anthology, David Trinidad and Jack Skelly, and we have the editor, Nicholas Christopher, who just this past year published his third book of poetry called Desperate Characters, which contains in it a kind of Chandler L.A. poem, a novel in poetry called Desperate Characters. Nicholas, are you there?
Yes.
Nicholas is talking to us from New York. Why Under 35?
Well, I thought it was a good, for very practical reasons, the Morrow Anthology of Younger American Poets, published some years ago, began with poets born in 1940 and ended with poets born around the Korean War. And I was one of the younger contributors to that. And it seemed to me there was a huge number of people, of real younger poets at this point, who were out there who weren't included in that book or in any others. So it was not an arbitrary point of departure. We had thought of doing 30 years old, and that's really quite young for poets, unlike fiction writers. They're really getting established later than that.
Well, we were joking earlier here with David Trinidad and Jack Skelly. They both appeared in an anthology called Coming Attractions, Poets in Their 20s, and now they're in Under 35. We were imagining the Under 40, the Under 50, and the SSI anthology. Will You Miss Me at the Home?
Right.
Now, you mention in your introduction that this is an anthology that in some way describes something that is happening in America, the death of the empire, and you liken it to the fall of the Roman Empire. And among the qualities that you talk about as being typical of the end of the American empire is an illiteracy, and with it, quote, an enervating popular culture that is attuned to the lowest possible denominator of sensibility. Now, since both of our poets here in the studio have written, in Jack's case, about Marie Osmond, in David's case, about Nancy Sinatra and girl groups, how does the use of popular culture material in the poetry differ from the popular culture as it appears in the tabloid?
Well, I think the way a poet uses any material, whether it's pop material or, quote, more serious subject matter, and I really think all subject matter is serious, the way the poet takes it and transforms it is a commentary on the pop culture. It's not, I mean, he's not doing a television jingle. He may be talking about how the jingle affects your psychology, or how an onslaught of jingles, or what the mass media, what we see on television especially, coming at children, what that's doing to their minds. I mean, the poet is really several steps back from that, talking about it. And a poet writing in America today who is not referring to, using symbols from, commenting on the popular culture might as well be in Iceland. I mean, he'd lose a huge amount of his material. But I don't think that's quite the same thing as producing the material he's drawing from.
As an editor, you are choosing, even Under 35, from a vast segment of American poetry. What are the criterion? You know, how do you answer the unhappy, baleful voice of, you didn't ask me?
Oh, I know. Well, I mean, there's really no answer except I'm sorry if I hadn't heard of the person, which happened. It's a huge country, and I had a very finite amount of time to gather the poems. So there's some wonderful people who should be in this book who aren't. There are also a huge number I turned down simply subjectively whom other people might put in. I mean, I had perhaps six times as many people who sent me work as appear in the book now. And there's not much you can say except that I liked these 37 the best to those people. Many of them have written to me saying, I should be in the book. I've read it, and I'm really wonderful. And I'm sure they are. And you know, it's a very subjective business, which is why you have an editor's name on it. This is the group I thought was strongest and really spoke with the strongest voices, which is what I looked for.
We're talking to Nicholas Christopher, the editor of Under 35, the new generation of American poets, recently published by Anchor Books in paperback. I'm really curious, Nicholas. The comment that I've been hearing about the anthology is that it seems that a good deal of the work is academic.
Mm-hmm.
And you thank, in the course of the introduction, quite a few teachers who are, you know, famous and generous at American workshops around the country. To what extent do you fear or did you fear that the anthology just represents the ghettoization of poetry in university workshops around the country?
Well, I was afraid of that because of the whole workshop business, and most of us teach in various universities. I teach here at NYU and at Columbia at different times. The people I thanked were really people who gave me names, and the people whose names I got gave me other names is what happened, and I really shied away from getting people who were the stars of writing programs, which could happen. I simply avoided that by not using that as a resource. But inevitably, I mean, I look through the biography myself, the biographies of the poets. So many of them are teaching because that's the way poets make a living here. You know, in Italy, poets are editors in publishing houses. In Britain, they do all kinds of other writing. And American poets, unless they want to have a, quote, regular job, which might be hard on them, tend to teach. And a lot of them now, I only have a BA. When I came through, there weren't writing programs to speak of. I just started writing, and I teach because of my books. But many of the poets I teach now in a graduate program have to compete hugely within the program for teaching fellowships and positions afterwards to support themselves. So, I mean, your question's a really good one. It's hard to find people who really can avoid doing that completely and are writing poetry, and I tried very hard to.
Well, let's take a for instance.
Okay.
David and Jack are not particularly associated with any writing program, at least not at the time when you chose them. How
right.
did they come to your attention? I'm talking about them because David Trinidad and Jack Skelly are Los Angeles poets and in the studio with me now.
Absolutely. They came to me. I don't remember the poet who told me about them. David Lehman gave me the name of a couple of poets, and one of those poets told me about, I think it was Elaine Equi, in fact, who's a friend of David's, who's in the book, who's a poet who lived in Chicago. And she said, you know, there's some wonderful poets in Los Angeles. And being from New York, I must say, most of the literary world here thinks that the United States ends at the Hudson. So most of my legwork was in going around the country. I knew who were good poets here and in New England.
Well, one of the reasons that I, on this show, Bookworm, have editors and anthologists on the show is to help there to be a gradual awareness that a lot of Los Angeles writing goes on that isn't Bret Easton Ellis. There's a sort of strange imagination that one writer inhabiting 30 or 40 different bodies lives in Los Angeles, and once you've published him, you're done.
Right. No, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more because, frankly, I'd never done an anthology before. I'm not a professional anthologist, and when I got into this, the hardest part was going to other regions where people weren't familiar. The best part of doing this book was finding poets in Chicago, Houston, Seattle, Los Angeles, whose names I'd seen in quarterlies, but I didn't know where they were writing out of. And there's an awful lot of writing. I had a lot of good applicants from Los Angeles. Jack and David were really the best, which is why they're in the book. But I was really stunned at how much good work I saw from New Mexico, from a lot of places in the West, and really a lot of those places have many more young poets who are thriving and know one another and are working very hard than people in New York who are kind of disparate.
I'm going to turn now to the two poets we have in the studio, David Trinidad and Jack Skelly, and I guess start by mentioning that, as I implied, that a good deal of the poetry that is by you in this anthology, Under 35, is influenced by pop. What do you think leads Los Angeles poets more than others to turn to pop as an aesthetic, as the basis for an aesthetic? David?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's necessarily a regional thing. A lot of the poets who influenced my interest in writing about pop culture live elsewhere. Tim Dugos in New York, Elaine Equi in Chicago, Jerome Sala also, who was in Chicago. So I don't think it's necessarily something that just happens here in Los Angeles.
Jack?
Yeah, it does happen everywhere else, but although you got to admit that L.A. is one of the main, you know, turner-outers of pop culture. I mean, it's the Tinseltown, you know, place where images are made. But David's right. I mean, you know, any poet will really seize on popular culture because that's, you know, what is surrounding us all.
David Trinidad has published two books of poetry, Monday Monday and Pavan, and he has a couple of chapbooks that are available. What are the titles of those?
November and Three Stories.
That were published by Raymond Foy at Hanuman Press. And Jack has his books, Monsters from Little Caesar Press, and two books from, is it Ouija Madness?
It's for Illuminati Press.
Illuminati Press, yeah. Called Fear of Kathy Acker and More Fear of Kathy Acker.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of Fear of Kathy Acker. I noticed in these poems that, in a certain way, the figures from pop culture provide substitute targets for love. In David's poem, the girl groups are the target of a lot of yearning and a lot of emotion that wants to be expressed as directly as the girl groups sing. In your poem to Marie Osmond, which has appeared in Harper's Magazine as well as in Los Angeles venues, Marie Osmond becomes sort of like Helen of Troy. I thought I'd begin by asking you to read the ode to Marie Osmond, which is now, I guess, making its second national appearance in the Under 35 anthology.
Mm-hmm.
This is Jack Skelly reading Ode to Marie Osmond.
There you are again, your crystal perfect face on the cover of the Inquirer. It seems you're everywhere this spring, on more magazines than April has roses. And yes, your series flopped, but you really are more suited to the slit sequined dresses of NBC than to family-circled declarations of virginity. Lips of a TV Venus should pucker, not pout. And what a waste that the nine men you love, hinted at in this week's Star, turn out to be your father and eight brothers. That the husband you dream of would be another perfect virgin. Your daddy's Mormon domain is as barren of life as his head is of hair. Let me be your conquering consort, and you'll be a far richer heiress. When the shadows of Utah's long winter are fled, and you stand alone on the Rockies, surveying an ancient city of soft buildings which transubstantiate and interpenetrate in moon aluminum evening, where warm, head-lighted insects dance in circles, and golden movie star men stand upright among beasts, holding tokens of serpents, sunglasses, electric guitars. Put aside your moral raiment, and I alone among them come forth to offer a litany of ardor. My bride, my guide, my lady, my baby, couch of wisdom, crystal meth connection, green plastic garden pail, ice-covered pencil sharpener, brand new house in white-hot flames, bright painted gate to beautiful things. interlocking dancers' thighs of black diamonds. Mystical video disc, unfolding precisely like flowers. Tree-lined La Cienega to Hollywood in autumn. Angel of the air arriving in clean reception. Woman made of cities, intricately busy with her own construction. Once we were the issue of chaos, Marie, asleep in the snows of virtue. Now we wake up to mutual delight as priests and presidents wither into indefinite night.
That's Jack Skelly reading Ode to Marie Osmond, which is included in the Under 35 anthology. Jack is often what? An imp-sized insurgent demanding attention from the female race, whether it be Kathy Acker or Marie. But David Trinidad, also in the studio, has another attitude toward the female race who are kind of there in profusion for him. In a way, his is the pop culture of replication, and in his wonderful poem, Meet the Supremes, there is a middle section which calls upon all of the girl groups as if they were the ships in the Iliad in battalion. I'm honored that the book that this poem first appeared in, which is Monday, was dedicated to me, and during the time of its writing, I was thrilled to be, you know, a temporary critic. I'm going to ask David to read the middle section of that poem, Meet the Supremes, where the narrator suddenly, having described his sort of lovelong ardor fed by girl groups, turns and lists them all.
I just wanted to say that we had talked about this earlier, that when I was writing the poem, I talked to Michael. I was in the middle of writing it, and I said something like, well, I want to put all these names of these girl groups in, and I don't quite know how to do it. And he suggested that I just break off in the middle of the poem and have this list of names. So it was Michael's idea.
But an honor to be honored by a poem so wonderful.
Okay, well, here it is. Darlene Love, Brenda Lee, Dee Dee Sharp, Martha Reeves and the Vandellas, the Chantels, the Shirelles, the Marvelettes, the Ronettes, the Girlfriends, the Ragdolls, the Cinderellas, Alice Wonderland, Annette, the Beechnuts, Nancy Sinatra, Little Eva, Veronica, the Pandoras, Bonnie and the Treasures, the Mermaids, Evie Sands, the Pussycats, the Patty Cakes, the Trans Sisters, the Pixies Three, the Toys, the Juliettes and the Pirouettes, the Charmettes, the Powder Puffs, Patty Lace and the Petticoats, the Revlons, the Ribbons, the Fashions, the Petites, the Pinups, Cupcakes, Chiclets, Jelly Beans, Cookies, Goodies, Sherries, Crystals, Butterflies, Bouquets, Bluebells, Honeybees, Dusty Springfield, the Raindrops, the Blossoms, the Petals, the Angels, the Halos, the Hearts, the Flamettes, the Goodnight Kisses, the Strange Loves, and the Bitter Sweets.
You know, that's such a beautiful list. What it makes me think in both cases, I think there was a movie called Where Love Has Gone. And
with Susan Hayward and Betty Davis. Yes.
And in a great way, I do think that these are, both of these poems, Jack's and David's, are substitute love poems. Poems that choose, that can name love objects simply because they're distant, almost as if this time has no way of inventing love poetry that might be more direct and its object more present. Do you have anything to say? Have you written? Is it possible today to write love poetry to literally to a lover directly? Can it still be done?
Well, probably not without a lot of irony, you know, just because it's just so, you know, just it sounds so corny given the age we live in with where the images of love are so perverted anyway. So, you know, That was sort of my idea with the Marie Osmond poems, or similar poems to that, was to sort of celebrate and yet make fun of the way popular culture, say, would fixate an image, female image, and try to foist it on the public.
David, on the other hand, while not being a love poet, you have done poems that make loneliness a kind of love object, as much a substitute as the girl groups. What's your feeling about the expression of emotion in modern poetry?
Well, I think it's difficult to just sort of come out and write a direct love poem to someone. But I know that with the girl groups, they were a symbol for me, because my obsession with girl groups began when I was in puberty, and that's the feeling I tried to capture in the poem.
Nicholas, are you there?
I'm still here.
Nicholas Christopher, who's the editor of this anthology. When I was going through the anthology, I did notice that there is a lot of substitution that goes on across the board in this anthology, that virtually unanimously the poets choose replicas or substitute objects of passion to stand in for the real thing, facsimiles or what is the word nowadays, simulations. Do you have any attitude toward that as editor, or even, you know, is it a symbol of the decline you talk about in the introduction to the anthology, that so much emotion has become mimetic rather than amorous?
Yeah, I mean, I think it has a lot to do with that decline business, and I think Jack made a good point in saying that notions and terminologies of love are so perverted, from toothpaste ads to right up. I mean, those words semantically have lost all meaning, and the symbols used around them, or the emblems, have as well. And I think with poets, they've got to sometimes do double and triple reversals and whammies to make something come alive like that. I mean, I think your notion of substitution is a good one, to break through. I mean, a good poem is going to break through for someone. It's going to jump off the page. It's going to make things explode. It's going to make something happen, the reader's imagination. And if you're just giving sort of rote business, or not taking those symbols out of the really complexity of the culture they're in now, you'll never do that. You'll just be another voice sort of blending into the chaos. I think it's difficult to do, and I think that device, I think you have a very good point, is being used by a lot of these poets. There's a Jimi Hendrix poem in this anthology like that, where she's really talking about a love affair breaking up and a bad friendship. And she does it all in a sort of quasi-examination of Hendrix, or using him as an emblem for the loss.
Well, it's not just pop figures, it's sort of language constructions in general. There becomes this very strange feeling that I receive from a lot of the poems, and it may be the post-Ashbery poem in general, that a kind of language process was replacing any kind of direct address, so that the poet is, I don't know, communicating to language first, even before it can become the vehicle of address, of people, objects, affection. A little bit scary, the amount of distance that I found in these poems.
Well, you know, a conservative response to that, which I wouldn't agree with, would be, well, these are young poets.
Used to be the most passionate.
But not in America anymore. It's a hard place to be that young. You've got to watch out when you're passionate here, or somebody may zap you. And I don't think that's really it. I don't think that conservative answer, well, they're digesting their predecessors and finding their own voices, that goes on anyway. But I think it's really, in some ways, a matter of caution. I mean, I got that empire idea because I really saw the work in here as a product of the Reagan years of huge denial. And I'm not a particularly hugely political poet, but I began to look at a lot of the work very politically, looking at it in this sort of artificial way, getting dozens of poets sending me work.
Jack, tell me, one of your most recent poems is called Surfing and Spying. Mm-hmm. And I remember a bunch of years ago that the spy versus spy phenomenon in LA art was starting to appear, and you yourself edited a magazine called Barney, the modern Stone Age magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Is it easier to address the pileup of imagery around us than it is to reach through to, I don't know, the actual ocean or the target of the spy's quest? Is the secret ever available? This sounds like...
I don't know.
This sounds like Geraldo.
I don't know where to begin with that. Just the idea behind that kind of poem, Spy, Surfing and Spying, was just to sort of... not to deal directly with the subject matter of spying, but just the terminology of it, and to construct, poetical creation out of that.
David, now you are, unlike many LA poets, in a writing program at Brooklyn College.
Yes.
Why did you make that choice? What led you
to
the
school? I wanted to live in New York, and it seemed like a good way to do it, to go back to school. And I had just left a full-time job that I was very unhappy in, and going back to school seemed like a nice transition to what I'm going to do next, which looks like it's teaching. So at the time Nicholas's book was put together, I wouldn't have called myself an academic, but I am now in an academic environment.
What is your sense of the poetry coming from your program?
Well, I'm studying with Allen Ginsberg and Joan Larkin, and they emphasize getting at the emotion, being direct, and I feel it's influencing me.
Certainly, you've been more productive there in New York than for years here in Los Angeles. Is that simply the time that a writing program gives you to write, or is there something? Did you find something freeing about New York itself?
I think it's both, both things. I mean, it's. I have more time to write, and I'm around a lot of interesting people, and New York is very exciting, and there's a lot of energy there that you can tap into.
Jack Skelly is a member of a newly formed band called Game Show, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? Has that helped or distracted you from poetry writing?
I always found writing music and poetry were two different things for me. It was like two different limbs or something. And it hasn't really had much of an effect, on the other. Although I enjoy writing lyrics, and there is some interplay there, but not a whole lot.
I have enjoyed having Nicholas Christopher with me, the editor of Under 35, the new generation of American poets from Anchor Press. Thank you, Nicholas.
Thank you.
And David Trinidad and Jack Skelly have been with me in the studio. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Barb Carlson. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and we'll see you next week on The Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. The land of ice is flowing books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold, and books,
books, books, books, books, books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse,
want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.